Hi, and welcome to Forecast, a show about climate scientists and climate science. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today I'm talking with Lauren Andrews from the University of Texas at Austin. Lauren just wrapped up her PhD and is heading towards a postdoc at NASA Goddard in the cryospheric branch. I know Lauren from handling one of her papers in Nature back in 2014, and it's one of many I've handled over the years, looking at some aspect of subglacial hydrology and the overall interaction of ice sheets and the continents below them and the oceans around them. It's a topic that I kind of feel like we're going to be done with every now and then, and then some great new science comes along and you realize that in many ways we're just getting going on trying to track down some of the details that are involved in controlling how fast the ice sheets are moving out towards the oceans. Lauren and her advisor, Jenny Catania, looked at a specific set of instrumentation where they had both pressure measurements and moulins, these channels going from the surface down to the bed, and also in boreholes that they themselves drilled. And the goal there was to try and kind of figure out how the water delivery to the base is actually done and how it's distributed, and then realizing ultimately that there's a big part of the bed of the ice sheet that isn't really connected to other parts of the ice sheet, but is still quite important. I think in many ways, the community that's looking at these issues has moved away from the idea that there's a simple lubrication effect where more water delivered to the base of the ice sheet necessarily means that it'll speed up, and to understanding that there's really a host of different factors, both in the way that the ice receives that water at the base, and then the basal conditions and the timing of it. And it's turned out to be quite a bit more complicated than people thought it would be initially. So I think it's definitely still in the process of being figured out, but clearly now there's no direct expectation that more meltwater means faster ice movement. And we talk quite a bit about that. Also about Lauren's interest in photography, some of the issues she faced in having to take responsibility for her own fieldwork in a way that most PhD students really don't have to do. I hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guest. Thanks a lot. Lauren Andrews from the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're sort of almost neighbors. You grew up in Northern California from a very young age. Where did you grow up?
I grew up just outside of a town called Redding. We're just sort of at the northern tip of the Central Valley in California. We raise sheep and a variety of other animals. So it's been a different experience moving to Texas.
I've only been through Redding once, I think on my way to Lassen for camping. And it has a vibe of an old-timey agricultural town, but they're also trying to do things to, it looks like, just attract tourism. They have this new Calatrava Bridge and a development around there. How has the town changed over the past couple of decades?
I think that in a lot of ways, it's very similar. I mean, I see the same people, you know, I know people when I go into the grocery store, but I think that they've made a really great effort because there's been a transition in sort of the agricultural and logging communities to being more open to tourism. And so there's the Sundial Bridge. And of course, it's a great jumping off place if you're a backpacker or a hiker, because it's a beautiful area up here.
It truly is. I could not find a good restaurant when I was there. Where should I go eat next time?
There is it's called Moonstone Bistro. It's actually located a little bit east of Redding. But what's really great, we have a couple family friends who run a large sheep ranch, and they actually supply a lot of the meat to the bistro. And it's a great little place. The chef's doing great things.
That is good to know. Thank you. So you grew up on a farm. I guess your parents are still involved in farming. What was your early experience and exposure to science?
You know, I think that it's always good to acknowledge the fact that, you know, my dad is a groundwater hydrologist, and we have a small property where we have sheep, and that's often, you know, a lot of the farms out here, people have day jobs, and then they run their farms or their ranches on their off time, on their weekends, when they have a chance. I mean, obviously, my early experience is my father. I remember doing a science project when I was in fourth grade about water filtration. And we looked at how water filters through different porosities and different grain sizes.
So you had an early introduction to hydraulic conductivity in Darcy's Law, it sounds like.
Exactly. I didn't notice such until I reached college, but yes.
You had the intuitive understanding. Did you? And so you went through high school in Reading, is that right?
I did. So I did middle school and high school here. I was involved in both 4-H and FFA, raising Suffolk sheep and actually chickens for a while. And so it was definitely, I think, a different experience than most of my colleagues when I was in college.
Very likely. Now that we're out here in California, we go to a lot of state fairs. Actually, my wife goes with her son to the state fairs because I kind of can't take it. It's a bit too much for me.
really overwhelming.
But when I have gone, I've just been so amazed by the kids that are in 4-H. And so these are kids that are 10, 11, 12 years old, who have a huge amount of responsibility for the animals they're raising and taking care of them and knowing how to show them, train them. And I know that later on in your graduate career, you had to assume a lot of responsibility for running field campaigns. Did those early experiences with programs like 4-H then kind of come into play down the road for you?
I think that there was definitely a benefit. I mean, I was the president of my 4-H club. I ran meetings. I did fundraising, did organization. And I think, too, just learning how to schedule your time. Often my parents would drop us off at the county fair and say, see you at 9 p.m. when we come to pick you up. And so there's a lot of learning how to manage what you need to do, what's immediate, what is, you know, something you can do the next day, and sort of organizing your time plays a big role in managing animals and growing up on a farm. So it makes a big difference. Definitely. It's definitely helped me down the line.
I have almost no experience of being in a farm, but I can kind of imagine that there must be a daily stream of things that could be taken to small emergencies. So did you have to learn how to sort of just triage things and understand what's a real problem that must be dealt with immediately and what can perhaps wait until next week?
Yeah, my father always likes to say, well, if it's eating and breathing, it's probably fine. So you can move on from there. And I think that, you know, that's an important thing in Arctic and Antarctic fieldwork too. It's learning when something is going well and when something needs sort of immediate attention. And when you're doing fieldwork like I've done, where, you know, you have a helicopter standing by, you have to know the steps. What are you going to do? Triage the situation. What's wrong? How can I fix it? And if I can't fix it, what's the next best option?
Before you got involved in polar research, you spent a couple of years working as an environmental consultant on acid mine drainage issues in Shasta County. What drew you to that work initially?
So I had an early introduction. My father does some of the work, or does a large amount of the acid mine drainage work here in Northern California. So I was looking around when I was in college for a senior thesis. And what's so interesting about the treatment of acid mine drainage is that this is a problem that occurs naturally, but we've sort of exacerbated it as we've excavated a lot of the sulfide ore bodies in Northern California. In fact, Shasta County was one of the largest producers of copper and zinc in the early and mid 1900s. Mm-hmm. And the weird thing here is everything is so isolated. And so it's this problem of getting important technologies and finding the best technologies for treatment that can actually deal with being very remote. And that's one of the things that drew me both to treatment of acid mine drainage and to glaciology in general.
So just the challenge of approaching those sort of problems and being able to deal with them and plan for them and work through it.
Yes, I think that that's definitely the case. I love the challenge of, you know, showing up to a field site and you're like, oops, I forgot that crescent wrench. How can I get it to work?
So you clearly didn't see yourself as a consultant for the long term. What made you choose to leave the private sector and go to grad school?
I think that as I was finishing my undergraduate career, it became clear I definitely needed a break and I needed to sort of walk away and figure out what I was really interested in. And so I took a couple years, and one, I took it easy and took a break, and that was really great for me. And then I also had the opportunity to just sort of explore, like look for graduate schools and people I wanted to work with on a time frame that was more realistic for me. I often see undergraduates at the University of Texas, pushing, they have finals and then they're trying to, you know, get all of their grad school applications done and get and finish their thesis. So for me, it was taking that break and exploring really what I wanted to be interested in.
I was completely fried when I finished my undergrad. I needed a couple of years off before I went back.
Oh, yes. I'm a big advocate whenever I have people talk to me about, you know, how should I proceed? I'm definitely like, take a break and figure out what you do.
What drew you to UT Austin and your advisor, Jenny Catania, in particular?
So I applied to UT Austin as a backup. I was actually planning on going to UC Davis here in California. And I just remember meeting with Jenny, and she is such a vibrant personality and has a great passion for what she does. And I fell in love with both her and the field of glaciology at the same time. You know, it was one of those serendipitous meetings where you sort of have a meld of personality and, you know, how you think. So I took a leap and moved to Texas.
2009 must have been kind of the perfect time to enter glaciology. So we'd had the fourth assessment report of the IPCC, where they had basically said, we have no idea what the dynamical contributions of the polar ice sheets might be to sea level rise. And I think everyone just said, oh, that's a problem. And it so it sparked this huge amount of research, at least partially from that. And then there was also Jay Zwolle's paper in Science, which raised the specter that increased melt from the Greenland ice sheet might dramatically speed up ice velocities, and you have a sort of a runaway melting away of the Greenland ice sheet. I mean, conceptually, it's this simple idea. You lubricate the bed, everything goes more quickly. What was your perception of the field of glaciology at the time? So were you already aware of these issues, or did you kind of come into it thinking, oh, this could be kind of cool, and then realize the magnitude of what was at stake?
I definitely came into glaciology with the idea like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like, you know, there's field work in Greenland and Antarctica. And I think that there's a lot of people who actually do that and then maybe don't admit it after the fact. A few years ago, you had Jay's paper, which really demonstrated that ice sheet, even land terminating parts of the ice sheet, can change in speed very, very rapidly on the order of, you know, hours, weeks. And so I think that there was this sort of phenomena of what's going on. Do we really understand the processes going on here? And you know, it was a great time to, you know, start to get into, you know, meeting people and understanding how the processes work. It's been a great experience.
I think people really were sort of terrorized by by James Wally's paper, because it did suggest that things could get quite dire real quickly.
I think that there definitely Jay's paper provided this sort of like, maybe we should be working on this problem a little bit faster. And I think over the past few years, we've gone through and done more field studies, looked at data more closely, and we've seen sort of a shift from this runaway effect to the idea that, yes, we have seasonal perturbations, but how the subglacial system behaves can essentially act as there's a feedback in that system. So you could get slower velocities later after melt has started because the character of what's going on at the bed has changed over time. And so I think that, you know, you have this, in a way, an alarmist paper. And then as a community, we've said, well, let's look at the details more closely. And I think that over time, we've learned a lot more both about ice flow and how subglacial hydrology can interact with ice flow.
I think I started at Nature about when you began grad school. And we've published a series of papers now on some aspect of this problem. So we had a theoretical paper by Christian Schoof that showed you have, it's really sort of the pulsing of meltwater inputs that matter, but you can have this switching from channelized drainage to more distributed flow, and you can have a switch between a highly pressurized bed in which you actually could get a lubrication effect, and then channels developing that can efficiently drain out that meltwater. And then we had remote sensing from Sundal showing the sort of the seasonal slowdown that you're talking about. And then in other journals, you know, Pete Nidnow's group has been showing that you have more kind of alpine glacier-like effects where you have these big variations in velocity. And then in, I think it was 2014, was it 2014 in your paper in Nature or 15?
It was 2014.
Can you set the stage relative to what people were thinking at the time? What were you trying to address with your paper relative to what people had already thought was happening?
We did our field work in 2011 and 2012. We had gone out and used the traditional sort of glaciological method of drilling boreholes and installing pressure transducers. But one of the things that's very common in glaciology is that a lot of your boreholes don't necessarily connect to maybe where you want them to connect to a part of the subglacial system that's really active. So we had the idea, and here I want to attribute this very specifically to Jason Gulley, who had been thinking about this from a karst hydrology perspective, to instrument these moulins with pressure transducers in order to be assured of the fact that we would be in a very channelized or a very efficient part of the subglacial system, with the idea that we would be looking at the contrast between the two.
So you need to have both the boreholes and the moulins instrumented mm-hmm. simultaneously.
Yes. I mean, I think that the problem on Greenland is you have very thick ice, and so the number of boreholes you can drill with the fuel that you're able to bring out into the field is very limited. So our idea was, instead of gridding boreholes like you see on Bench Glacier, Joel Harper has done a great job, and Christian Schuf and Gwen Flowers have done some significant field work drilling a wide range of boreholes. With the thickness, instrumenting moulins allows us to get at both of the systems effectively. And we saw really contrasting behavior between the two. In our moulins, our water pressures, our water levels varied on the order of 150, 200 meters a day, which is really significant in any sort of hydrologic system.
This is just the pressure head.
Yes, this is just simply that the water level moving up and down over the course of a single day. In our boreholes, we saw a completely different behavior. They were out of phase with our ice velocities, and they also had much lower magnitude. There was inverse scaling between the borehole water levels and ice velocity, suggesting that you had some sort of flow coupling that was really driving the pressures in these areas. But what we did notice is that over the course of our observation window, which was mid to late season in 2012, we saw a changing relationship between the moulin water level and the ice velocity. So earlier in the season, you had a higher pressure for a given ice velocity than you did later in the season. And that really suggested that you had some evolution in the system that we couldn't readily explain with a simple channel model. Then we started to look at what our boreholes were doing and sort of start to really think about the system. And this is where I think science really gets done, where you have some data and they don't necessarily fit the paradigm that you are expecting them to fit. And so you have to start to think, and you just sort of throw around ideas. I had a number of individuals who are co-authors on the paper with whom we discussed what was going on, what could be going on. And what we did observe is that in two boreholes at one particular site and then at other boreholes, we saw a gradual decline in pressure.
In the borehole.
In the boreholes over the course of our observation window, that was suggesting that despite their behavior suggesting that they were probably really poorly connected to sort of this efficient subglacial channel, that their pressures were declining. And if you think about Jay Zawali's lubrication idea, the more water and the higher pressure you have over the bed, the more you're sliding. So it's that integrated pressure. And so if you have a gradual connection and a gradual decline in pressures in these isolated regions, you could, in fact, slow down ice velocities without having significant change in your hydraulic head.
And What's been the follow-up to that research when you've presented this work, talked about it? Has the community thought, that kind of makes sense? Are there major alternative interpretations to the data?
I think that as a graduate student, I've been lucky in that the idea that the unconnected regions of the bed play an important role has been fairly well received. In fact, my colleague, Matt Hoffman, gave a talk on some of the modeling he's been doing with this idea in mind, and at AGU actually this past week, and it was well received. When you pose sort of a newer idea, or really you go back and you look at some old data and you know what scientists have been doing in the past, and you sort of reinterpret what you think you're seeing, it's always great to have some validation in terms of modeling. And Matt's really starting to show that this unconnected system could play an important role. And I think you can think of several mechanisms that could be causing this, but I think as a community, we're moving toward the idea that, in fact, water is pretty focused where it gets to the bed. And so that leaves a lot of bed of the ice sheet relatively unconnected.
So you're having these major inputs from the moulins that are draining the superglacial water that are having a kind of a localized effect, but then the areas between that end up being quite important for how that influences the overall ice velocity.
Exactly. And that sort of space in between can be dependent both on the subglacial topography and sort of the subglacial hydraulic potential, as well as the conductivity within either till or gravels at the bed or along that bedrock interface.
So it's, all of which means it's more complicated than people thought it was going to be initially.
I think that's definitely the case. I think that we are sort of reaching peak complexity in Greenland. Great papers suggesting that there are widespread sediments at the bed of the ice sheet by Fabian Walter and Christine Dow. And so once you start throwing sediment into subglacial models, things start to get complex very quickly.
I always think about complexity in science and complexity or ideas in peak oil, and the peak of peak oil keeps getting pushed back higher and higher. You ran two complex field campaigns during grad school, and you had to assume a lot more responsibility than most graduate students would during their time in school. And part of that was because your advisor, Janie Catania, had some personal issues that made it difficult for her to take that kind of leadership that you might usually have. What was that like for you as a student? It must have been a surprise. You must have had kind of a mix of sympathy for your advisor and what she was going through, but also I'm imagining some level of apprehension about the responsibility you then had to bear.
So I think I'll first start off by saying that I've had, like many grad students, a great number of mentors who've done some really great field work, including Martin Luthi and Martin Funk, who were at ETH Zurich, as well as Matt Hoffman and Bob Hawley here in the States. And I think that Ginny had some family issues, and really, so I learned how to run a field program from beginning to end, whether that was communicating with our vendors in terms of instrumentation, talking to helicopter pilots, which was a little nerve-wracking the first time I did that. You know, I'd seen Martin do it, and I had some experience being in a helicopter before, having to actually communicate, like, we need to go to this location and find this GPS unit that's a white disc on a white surface. But I think it gave me a lot of confidence in terms of realizing that even if you don't know exactly what's going to occur, if you take the time and pay attention, you can indeed get reasonable results and great results. Ginny's family issues were very difficult for her. And I think that I hope that she had some measure of relief that at least I could do a little bit of what she could do.
I know I would have been completely terrorized by the prospects of having to do what you did. What were your emotions as you were going into this, sort of knowing that you had to talk to the pilots, you had to deal with the vendors, you had to set up the GPS arrays?
Well, I was never in the field alone, which is always a, you know, there were always a lot of people who, you know, had some idea of what's going on. I actually first went into the field with Martin Luthy and Martin Funk at Görner Glacier in Switzerland. And I had never set foot on a glacier. And they did a great job of demonstrating how to be methodical in the field and how to be very cautious. And then in 2011, when we did the borehole drilling, they were there again. So I was really just in charge of the UT Austin portion of what was going on. But that was getting our borehole instruments to work and learning how to instrument moulins and putting those sensors in as well. And then in 2012, we went back with a much smaller group of people. There were four of us where we were installing pressure transducers and a number of moulins. And when you know you're going to go out for that first time, I think I still get a little nervous thinking about it. But I threw up that first time before we left the hotel, thinking about the helicopter, just knowing that there was a lot of equipment and there was a lot of time and there were a lot of, we were really hoping to get some great results.
That sounds like a completely reasonable reaction to have.
But it turned out to be a really enlightening field season. We had a lot of rain when you're on the ice sheet. It's a pretty miserable place to be, but we did get some great results. And I don't often tell people this, but I actually got engaged on the ice sheet during field season.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's amazing. Was there a ring involved? I guess you have sort of pick up your gloves and then your fingers are freezing. Let's get this over with as quickly as possible.
It was, Joseph McGregor is now my spouse. Actually, it was in the tent when it was raining. So it's perhaps not as romantic as you want to think it to be.
Memorable, though. Definitely memorable. That's fantastic. What do you look forward to when you go out on the ice?
Well, I think, you know, on the first order, it's sort of a disconnection from daily life, right? You don't have email. You don't have text messages. You don't have your cell phone. It's always busy. It's always very busy, but there's this calm and a routine sets in. And I really enjoy that about field work.
Just a level of focus and...
Exactly. The ability to sort of really focus very carefully on sort of very specific problems.
When I talk to the Danes about their field camp, it sounds like they're working very hard, but they're also having a really good time. And they have their, I think, weekly dress-up parties, and they're well-provisioned, it looks like. Are you working in a fairly lean crew? Is it just physically difficult, or do you have the capability to have a good time up there?
I think we always have a good time. You can always make jokes and tell stories. But I think it's a little bit different than sort of a traditional field camp like NEEM, because in 2012, it was four of us. So we had four tents, all of our equipment piled around us. And we're on, instead of a nice flat snow surface, we're on this really rough, bare ice terrain. You always want to pay attention. There's always crevasses and moulins. Safety is not something you take lightly. But despite that, you really get to know colleagues when you're in the field. I think that I got over a lot of my fear of talking to scientists who'd been in the field for a long time just by being in the field with them, because you talk about the science, you talk about the weather, you talk about anything. When you're in a field camp like that, you often have a call-in with someone who's in Kangerlussuaq, and you know, we would always get the news update, and it was always fun to have them scrambling to look up what was happening in the world and to just learn about what was happening in the world when you were just in this completely different place.
Let's talk a little bit about just the process you went through publishing the Nature paper. We certainly publish papers from graduate students, but it's not that common. If you think back to the initial stages of conceptualizing the paper, did you know right away that this had a good chance in Nature, or were you thinking about sending it to Journal of Glaciology or GRL first?
As I was writing the paper, we waffled back and forth. We weren't really sure. We knew that our observations were unique, and we had a sense that this story might be important, but to be honest, we sent it to Nature with the firm expectation that we would be seeing it back in the next week. So
you thought it would be declined without review.
Correct. Yes. And the moment that you actually called me on the phone, I don't think I've been that nervous in a very long time. We had initially thought we were planning on Nature Geoscience, and then Jason Gulley suggested that maybe we should try, like at least try. And I think that it's always a good thing to try. So that's what we did.
I agree. I mean, we always encourage people to try Nature first, because you'll, as you say, you'll get an answer within a week or so, and then you can always transfer to geoscience or climate change afterwards if you'd like to. So you got the initial notification that we were going to have it reviewed, and then the reviews come back. If you were to sort of describe the overall peer review process in Nature relative to the other papers you've published or been involved with, were they pretty similar, or did you find them to be quite different?
I think that in a large part, they were very similar. You got back your reviews from two individuals, and then I had a third sort of commentary on mine. And you sort of read through them, and you have that period of like, oh, maybe we can't address all of these. And then you start to think, and you start to think about how to, you know, restructure the paper based on your reviews. And then you find, I think I finally got to a point where I was like, okay, like we can do this. Maybe not in 2 weeks, but we can do this.
and the 2 weeks is kind of aspirational.
That's good, because I felt really bad because my husband and I had planned a vacation and we had just gotten the reviews back, and we were at an IGS meeting, International Glaciological Meeting in Chamonix, and had planned to go to Normandy. And so I was very appreciative of you in, you know, respecting the fact that we had planned a vacation.
Especially if it's, you know, it involves Normandy cider and crepes and that kind of stuff.
Oh, exactly. You know, as an aside, we were there for the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and to talk to people and to just be there during sort of this period of remembrance was pretty spectacular. It's something we won't ever forget. But back to the review process, it was sitting down and going through each comment line by line and doing your best to address them.
When I was an academic and I got reviews back, the initial reaction is sort of some combination for me of, oh, these reviewers are idiots, and a little bit of like anger and frustration. And then 3 days goes by and you're like, yeah, they're totally right.
There's always a little bit like, I tend to look at it slightly differently as, oh, maybe I wasn't as clear as I thought I should be, or I thought I was being. And I think that, you know, that is one of the great things about peer review, is I've never seen a paper that hasn't gotten better and more clear by going through peer review.
In terms of the impact on your career, I know that in some countries there are huge and immediate impacts to having a paper in Science, Nature, or Cell, or another high-profile journal. In your specific situation, did it really change anything for you? Or did it open up any new doors that wouldn't have been open if the paper had been in JGR or something else?
Well, I think that you can never second guess what has happened, but I had been very lucky in the first place, being at University of Texas and at the Institute for Geophysics, and that a lot of the support I had been there previously. And so I give them a lot of credit. And I was happy to have that paper in Nature. I think perhaps I tend to be fairly introverted. So dealing with the small amount of press that we had with that paper, really, I learned a lot, in fact, in how to interact with people and really how to communicate my science. So that might have been sort of the biggest outcome for me, is all of a sudden you have to learn how to communicate your science at a very a very straightforward level. So that was great.
So you needed to develop your elevator speech.
Exactly.
How do you describe your work now to someone who might be calling from the BBC? What would be sort of your one or two sentence explanation?
I think my two line explanation is generally like, we have melt on the Greenland ice sheet, and that water is getting to the bed in very specific locations through these large vertical shafts of water. We're talking, you know, lakes draining on the order of several hours, large volumes of water. And that water is getting to the bed and it's flowing along the bed. But how and where that water is on the bed can impact how ice moves and ultimately how the Greenland ice sheet can lose mass.
When I think about your kind of work, which you've just nicely encapsulated, and the other kind of work that we publish from a huge range of topics, sort of remote sensing and modeling, I sometimes wonder about if we're just kind of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Not because the mechanisms themselves are fascinating and they're scientifically very interesting, but do you ever have the feeling that with current rates of warming, that the Greenland ice sheet is just going to be gone? And what we're dealing with is just trying to understand the rate at which it goes, not its ultimate fate.
I tend to be a pessimist, so I tend to sort of fall in line with that perspective. But I have been lucky in that my spouse is very optimistic. Understanding the processes not only inform us about how these ice sheets might be collapsing, but I think that, you know, science in general is a very positive endeavor. And if we can in any way, if I can in any way contribute to how people think about climate change or think about how ice sheets and glaciers lose mass, beyond just simply understanding exactly how Greenland and Antarctica are going to melt away, touching people and talking about science can change how they behave in small ways. And I think that can be really important as well.
So you feel like there's a broader purpose beyond the immediacy of your specific findings?
Yes, I do. I think that our specific findings in glaciology, there's often, you know, many papers, you know, these glaciers and ice caps are losing mass and they're losing mass at faster rates. But you can't be all pessimistic or everyone's just going to continue as they are. You do the status quo and make no changes in how they behave.
In other words, if it's all pessimism, then people would just think, what's the point in trying to do any sort of mitigation? We're doomed anyway. So let's just continue on doing what we're doing.
Yes, exactly.
So now for a completely unfair question, which is about the paleo climate evidence. So there's been some work looking at neodymium isotopes off South Greenland, suggesting that in past warm periods, past interglacials, that, you know, huge chunks of the southern Greenland ice sheet destabilized and were gone. Results from NEEM for the Eemian had kind of contrary takes on it, saying that, at least from the Delta O18 estimates of temperature, you had a fairly minimal lowering of the ice sheet at NEEM for a pretty big warming. So for me, when I tried to understand what the ice sheet's done in Greenland in past interglacials, I find it to be, you know, a little confusing. I know the picture is still evolving, but from your discussions with colleagues at meetings, do you have any kind of a sense of the overall gestalt of, you know, what people think the stability of the Greenland ice sheet is relative to a certain level of warming?
There is definitely evidence that there's Eemian ice in the ice cores, and that can be identified in the radar layers as well. And so the ice sheet will not completely go away. And I think that that's an important reminder that there had been, you know, a large ice sheet during our last, you know, fairly significant warming.
Yeah, and there was clearly Eemian ice. Definitely.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that the processes that I study are sort of near terminus, right? They're very close to the edge of the ice sheet. And there is evidence that some of these processes have sort of a short-term impact, but maybe no longer-term impact. But I also think that there are outlet glaciers that are retreating very rapidly and losing a lot of mass very quickly. Zachariah, Petermann, Jakobshavn in Greenland. There's a large amount of mass near the edges that we're likely to lose that will contribute to sea level rise. So I think that understanding the processes of how these outlet glaciers and how these sort of slower moving land terminating regions behave can, you know, inform us about sort of that retreat history, that retreat pattern, which does in turn affect sea level rise.
One thing I wonder about with the major glaciers in Greenland and their mass loss and their retreat is that the spatial patterns and the temporal patterns are they're really variable. So in the past, in the near past, we had this massive retreat going on from southeastern Greenland, then it's sort of shifted towards northwestern Greenland. We just had a paper from Kurt Kier looking at past levels of retreat from the Little Ice Age and showing sort of constant levels, but then an acceleration. What is your take on, you know, what we can really say about the ongoing nature of this retreat relative to the very large signals you have in both spatial and temporal variability in the system? Is there any chance that the current signals are being overinterpreted, or is there any sense that the current rate of acceleration is going to reduce?
I mean, as a scientist, you do the best with the data you have, and you're always open to interpretation later on that suggests that your work, it perhaps went in the wrong direction or focused on the wrong thing. I think that if you look at the history of many scientific fields, you see that. I think the sort of current rate of acceleration can't really be maintained once you have these large outlet glaciers that retreat back onto being land terminating, which is likely to occur. You might see a slowdown in sort of the mass loss on the Greenland ice sheet.
Looking forward over the next few years, I know you'll be looking for either postdocs or faculty positions. Where do you think, or where would you like your career to take you in terms of professional placements?
Well, I do actually know for the next 2 years at least. I just finished my degree at UT.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's always a push at the end, I've learned.
Did you have the experience when you were finishing either the writing? I just felt like it was never going to end. And then one day it was just over. And you think, what? Now it's over?
I think that there's a lot of sense of that, right? Because you go to your defense and you have your committee members who have been to a large number of defenses and they've, you know, signed the paper and like executed this. And so like you sort of expect this sort of maybe almost ceremonial process and it's very straightforward and then it's done.
And then they're like, can we have coffee now? Is it over?
Yeah. You know, it's getting time to go home. So I'm going to go home. In that you're just writing and writing and writing and trying to make sense of what you do. And in a way, I think it's different than sort of typical science where you're interacting with a lot of people and communicating ideas because it is this very lone endeavor. And I'm very glad that I'm done with it.
And now you're moving on, it sounds like, to a 2-year postdoc.
Yes. So I actually received a NASA postdoctoral fellowship. And so I'm going to be moving to NASA Goddard, the cryospheric group there, and working with Tom Newman, looking at ice velocities using Landsat 8 and seeing if we can tease out mass loss from that. And also looking at longitudinal coupling or flow coupling. So how the ice interacts with itself. And so how forcings can be local or non-local in terms of the subglacial hydrologic system.
Is that more kind of ice rheology modeling than what you're doing previously?
It's going to be a bit more modeling and especially focusing on ice rheology than I've been doing. A lot of my work currently is focused mainly on the hydrology, the water at the bed.
The Landsat 8, is that going to be some kind of feature tracking algorithm?
Mm-hmm. There's been some great work by Mark Fonstock and a group of people that have really refined the pixel tracking or the pattern tracking algorithms and made some great strides in terms of improving our ability to resolve ice velocities.
Over what area will you be trying that?
So I'll be looking over much of Western Greenland, both where we have a thawed bed and an active hydrologic system and parts more northern where the bed is less likely to be thawed and may be experiencing some transition between sort of frozen to the bed and thawed.
So with Landsat, I think it's whatever, a 16-day repeat cycle, tons of cloud cover in Greenland, but I imagine you can still get probably seasonal snapshots.
Yes.
Is that about what you can hope for?
Yeah. So, you know, I went back and did the calculations in terms of what the ice velocities are in certain regions. And it does look like we'll actually be able to resolve sort of 2-week ice velocity variations, even in relatively slow moving regions.
And going all the way to mass, not just velocity.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give it a shot. So
I guess you have to have good radar data for those areas to get the ice thickness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, having ice thickness and surface topography. And I think that that's one thing as a community, we're starting to get much better resolution maps of the surface and of the bed, which makes a huge difference in terms of sort of interpreting science and making some inferences about what's going on at the bed.
It sounds like your interests are taking you more towards broader scale topics and a little bit away from the very detailed hydrological observations you've done for your PhD. Is that the case, or do you still see yourself having a strong sort of field observational component to your work?
So I think that that's the challenge of starting a postdoc, and where your sort of funding is not necessarily as generous as perhaps it was during grad school, when you're operating on a grant that has co-PIs who are doing very great things in science. And I think, you know, I'm moving to broader ideas, a little bit more remote sensing too, only because I'm not exactly sure what I want to do after my postdoc. Mm-hmm. In terms of science versus teaching, I've had some great experiences here at UT, TAing classes and teaching and interacting with students. And so I have sort of a branch of interests, and developing a research program that can be done either on the small scale or on the large scale, I think can make a big difference in terms of your flexibility and where you end up.
You're not only about science, you also have a collection of wonderful photographs on your website. Has that been a long time interest of yours?
So I've enjoyed photography, and I'm glad you found my website. It's always great to hear that people have taken the chance to browse my website.
It's great.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. You know, that's photography is something I picked up when I was in college. My father always says, well, you can take 1,000 photos and you'll get lucky if you have one or two great ones. So I guess I sort of take that approach. I know that there are people that do are much more focused and do a much greater job at taking the photos. But I think the most important thing for me is really documenting how science is being done and sort of the conditions that scientists work in Greenland.
Lauren Andrews from UT Austin, photographer and glaciologist, moving on to a postdoc at NASA Goddard. Lauren, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.